Hello, everyone. My name is Christina Andrews, and I'm a third-year doctoral student at SSA. And I have the pleasure of introducing Jean Marsh, our dean, and George Herbert Jones, distinguished professor today. So when Tina Zubnicki asked me if I'd like to say a few words of introduction for Jean Marsh today, of course, I was very honored. I sort of knew it was going to be no small feat to express in just a few words the breadth of Jean's contributions to the topic that we're here to talk about today. As an educator, a researcher, and a leader in our field, she's worked actively over the years to understand how social workers think and make decisions, how they learn, and what kinds of knowledge and expertise they need to work effectively in the field. And I think those of you in the audience today that know Jean well will agree that she's done a great deal to further each of these aims. And so in light of this, I will give my introduction the best shot that I can. So Jean's someone who's been at the front lines of the profession's effort to think about how research can best be used to inform social work practice. In 1993, she co-authored an influential book with Sharon Berlin, who we just heard from, entitled Informing Practice Decisions. The book surveyed an impressive body of literature on social cognition, decision-making, intervention theory, and clinical processes in order to understand how social workers can most effectively bring many kinds of knowledge to bear to inform social work practice. And Jean's someone who's really been on the front lines of this profession. The book brought an important and fresh perspective to the field by advocating for an inclusive model of decision-making that includes not only knowledge derived from research, but also the kinds of knowledge that come from clinical experience, observation, and intuition. As editor of Social Work, Jean made it a top priority to enhance the publication's relevancy for social workers. During her tenure as editor, she spearheaded a national survey of social workers to find out what kind of knowledge they found useful to their work and sought to bring new vigor to the missions of the journal to make research viable to practitioners in the field. Jean's also been an active contributor to the prominent debate regarding the value and appropriate use of evidence-based practice in social work. She's been a contributor to such influential volumes as Enola Proctor and Aaron Rosen's Toward the Development of Practice Guidelines for Social Workers, in which she took up the role of organizational context in using research to inform practice. She was also a contributor to Harold Briggs and Tina Zubnicki's Using Evidence in Social Work Practice, in which she makes the case for the importance of using theory to guide research to evaluate the effectiveness of practice. More recently, she published an article with Stan McCracken, which outlines a new and very practical model for how social workers can use their expertise to apply research in their work. In addition to promoting the use of evidence-based practice, Jean has also been committed to generating new research to inform the work of practitioners. Since I came to SSA as a doctoral student in 2006, I've been working with Jean as part of her NIDA-funded research to examine the impact of access to comprehensive services in substance abuse treatment for men and women dealing with addiction. Through this project, Jean sought to identify specific components of comprehensive treatment, such as access to mental health counseling, medical care, family services, housing, that can make a difference for clients. Her research has demonstrated that these services have a positive impact on client outcomes and points to new directions for both the organization and practice of substance abuse treatment. Her scholarship and leadership on this project has provided me with a model not only for how to do great research, but also for how I can place my own work within the service of social work practice. So now I'm happy to introduce to you someone who's been a wonderful role model and advocate not only for me, but for the profession more broadly. I'm really looking forward to hearing what she has to say today. So let's please give a warm welcome to our next speaker, Jean Marsh.
Thank you, Christina. It's really been my privilege to work with Christina as a doctoral student at SSA. Like all of our doctoral students, she's quite a remarkable individual and scholar and beginning researcher. And it's part of the privilege of being a faculty member at SSA is to have the opportunity to work with our doctoral students as well as our master's students. It's so far, this has been a great conference. Tina, Stan, Harold, these first two papers were stunning. I really appreciated I really appreciated the first paper and the construction of history, because in many ways this is a lived history for me. The notion of an ecogram, I think, is something that I've been very interested in over the years. The kind of intellectual legacy that we heard about was really part of my legacy. So when I came to Chicago, I came from Michigan, where I was working with Dick Stewart and Ed Thomas, and when Sharon came a few years later, she came from having worked with Scott Breyer, all of whom were working. Tony Tripodi was at Columbia with Bill Reed, and Scott Breyer was at Columbia with Bill Reed, and so there is that intellectual legacy that carries on in the current the current faculty at SSA. But the period that I came was really a very interesting period. It's the period that that we heard about, that that Ricky talked about, when the research of Bill and Laura was very actively going on, and it was clearly influencing the work that was going on at Michigan, because as part of my work with Dick Stewart, we were engaged in an empirical study of brief treatment compared with extended treatment for families of so-called pre-delinquents. I've always loved that word. At some level, I think we're all pre-delinquent, although sometimes we may pass over. But this was clearly at the same time, this work. I mean, it reminds me of the research on innovation that shows that ideas don't really happen. They don't get generated in one place, but they're happening in multiple places. And I think in terms of social work practice research, this was really going on, as Ricky said, at Washington or UCLA, at Michigan, at Columbia, and particularly at Chicago. So I entered as a naive assistant professor into this hotbed of important practice research, behavioral research that Elsie Pinkston was engaged in collaboration with the Tass-Sinard work that was going on with Bill and Laura. And it was really just a privilege for me to be here. It was a very exciting time, I think, in social work practice research history. There was an amazing amount of good work that has influenced the field significantly. So thank you, Ricky, for that characterization, for that analysis of social work practice history. I will say in my remarks that I think we really have to go back, as Sharon mentioned, before the 40s and 50s when we think about history, and certainly at Chicago to the founding vision of our founding mothers whose images hang before us. This book from the Netherlands, I think, is fascinating, that makes the effort of going back to Mary Richmond. Unfortunately, I can't read Dutch, but perhaps there's an English translation somewhere that we could all learn from. I also really appreciated Sharon's very erudite paper, which I think in a very effective way summarized where theory is in our field, where practice theory is, where cognitive theory is, where behavioral theory is, and how it all comes together. It's clearly also including really the biological bases of these theories. And I think at the integration of all of this is at the cutting edge of social work practice research. I know that Bill Borden carries on that work and is heavily involved in continuing this theoretical development, all in the tradition of the University of Chicago SSA history of practice research, which, as Sharon so aptly characterized, and to use Duff's word, is friendly to a variety of ways of thinking, but at the same time, very critical and always concerned, first and foremost, about advancing knowledge and improving practice for our clients. So let me just thank the two of you for two wonderful papers. I'm not sure my paper will be quite as wonderful, but let's get started. So what I'm hoping to do today, it's a little bit selfish because knowing that I would be in the presence of the current luminaries of social work clinical research, my aim is threefold. To review theory and empirical research about the development and use of knowledge in social work, to define evidence-based practice and analyze its growth in our field, and basically to place it in the context of research on social work practice currently. My motivations for the talk, this is probably where the selfish part comes, because I've had experiences in the last couple of years where I've been invited to conferences, and it becomes very clear in a short while that the reason I've been invited is to be the straw person in the embodying empirical or evidence-based practice, so that without any full definition of evidence-based practice or really any meaningful critical analysis, I and evidence-based practice is the target of enormous animosity. So this has made me curious to some extent about the epistemological bases of our ways of knowing, and the epistemological resistance, really, to the term evidence-based practice. I've also been very curious in terms of our field about proliferating models of research in social work. We hear a lot about research-informed practice, about reflexive practice, action research, intervention research, service user-led research, services research, decision research, and I think it's worth our time to reflect on what this terminology means and how it contributes to the ongoing development of practice research in social work. I have a related experience that that leads me to my curiosity about this. Well, I'll get into that later. So what I'd like to do then is to put all of this in the context of what Christina characterized as one of my enduring interests and curiosity, which is how practitioners use knowledge and use research in practice. So I have been, these many years, very interested in knowledge utilization in social work. And what we know, we can review briefly what we know about this at this point in time, that it rests at the intersection of practice and research, that it consists of a set of activities related to the awareness, consideration, and use of knowledge, and that there's increased interest in evidence-based practice. This increased interest in evidence-based practice contributes to an interest in knowledge and modes of inquiry that lead to knowledge use. Some research that was done really many years ago, at about the time that I was finishing my PhD and doing a postdoc at Michigan on knowledge utilization, identified that overall there are two basic kinds of knowledge that influence thinking about a problem. And they are both conceptual and instrumental. Conceptual knowledge being knowledge that influences our thinking about a problem, where instrumental knowledge is knowledge that is more means-ends knowledge to solving a problem. We can probably think of theory as the most likely source of conceptual knowledge and conceptual utilization, and empirical research as particularly relevant to solving a problem. But we also know that both theoretical and empirical evidence, as again Sharon so wisely identified in her own work, is important for advancing knowledge development and for knowledge utilization. Additional research that has been done has showed that not only social workers, but really all of us, but I suppose particularly social workers, rely on different sources of knowledge, and I think this is very important to think about as well. And I've characterized the first source as relational knowledge, that this is knowledge conveyed primarily through interpersonal contacts, through classroom education, agency supervision, collegial consultation, workshops, seminars. When I'll talk to you about some findings from the little study that we did that Christina referred to from social work, but we know that, and we know this from teaching, that our students and probably all of us give much more credibility to what we are told or is conveyed to us by a trusted source than we do by reading a journal article. So reading a journal article is what I'm referring to as textual knowledge, and some of this this perspective comes from my the opportunity I had to edit social work. And I, during this period, was eager to interact with the readers of social work, so I encouraged the readers to write to me as editor. And one of the most vivid descriptions that I received in exchange from a reader was the reader who said, both your editorials and the articles in social work are like chewing on cardboard. So clearly, this is, I think, a very vivid description of how textual knowledge can be hard to digest. So our founding mothers, I want to go back to the point I made earlier, that really this this thrust, this emphasis on evidence, on empiricism, really does go way back to the founding mothers. Again, this is one of my very favorite quotes from Edith Abbott, who said that if social research is to go on, it can only develop scientifically with the help of well-trained social workers. All the investigating techniques in the world will produce nothing but a multiplication of dullness unless those who are doing the work have a keen understanding of the problems to be solved. Otherwise, the investigator is but a headless machine. As you know, I incorporated that that vivid phrase into one of my earlier papers. But this is another lecture, but this was at a time when the women of SSA and the men of the sociology department were attempting to define a scientific base for their disciplines. And the women of SSA were very clear that practice knowledge, knowledge relevant to practitioners, applied knowledge was very important. And it was necessary if the work that was to be done was not to result in just being a headless machine. What part of the research that I returned to as a part of the centennial was to look at what Edith Abbott wrote in terms of what was special about a social work education as opposed to a sociology or disciplinary education. And she identified three factors: classroom work focused on theory and systematic analysis and the utilization of knowledge. She didn't really use these words, but this was the point. Field education, which was, of course, distinct from the kind of work that was being done in sociology in terms of education at the time. And research. Research was the third leg on the stool, the desire to learn from practice, to learn by intervening. So this, it would be a very interesting study to see if one were to go to the founding mothers or fathers at Michigan or Penn or Simmons, the early schools at the time, whether they would have characterized the unique elements of a social work education in quite this way, and whether they would have pulled out research. My sense of the history, although I haven't done the study, is that the founding mothers at SSA were particularly, probably given their background, they were very academic, they were of the university. They worked with Jane Addams, but it was clear that Jane Addams was a practitioner, and they saw themselves as researchers. So it's it probably is the case that this school was particularly focused on the use of evidence, empiricism, from the very beginning. I'm going to talk now a little bit about this study that Christina referred to, which was not a major survey. It was, in fact, a very minor research exercise that some students in my 445 class helped me with. But it seemed like having access to the readers of social work would be a wonderful opportunity to do what I learned very well as a social worker, that again, Ricky, I think, lifted up very well, which is to have respect for the perspective of either the client or, in this case, I was interested in the practitioner and what their interest in utilization was. So having access to all of those practitioners tempted me to ask them directly, what do you find useful? And as a result of this, we had 407 respondents. I mean, this was a little survey that I put at the end of an editorial in Social Work, and I was really gratified that that many people were interested to respond. Now, I don't know what the readership of social work is. It's probably at least 1,000 or 1,500. So this is not a great response rate if you look at it that way. But the fact that 407 people were motivated to address this subject is pretty amazing. The demographics reflected the demographics of the profession: 25% men, 75% women. The age also reflects the demographic of our profession, which is a little concerning in that two-thirds were over 40 years old and one-third under. Primarily a white group, and their primary fields of practice reflected very well what we know about the profession, or at least the membership of NASW, and 34% in mental health field and 14% in child welfare. So what were the results? What did we learn from this exercise? Well, I asked the respondents to tell us what type of content they valued the most in social work articles. And you can't really read all of the stems on those, but the overall findings were that they reported they were the content that was particularly helpful to them was content about social problems. The second most was information about effective practice, what is helpful in conducting practice, what is effective. Information about a particular population group. And finally, information about social work ethics. I think this is very important and distinguishes perhaps the concern of social workers, perhaps from other helping professionals. But we have been, from our very beginning, very concerned about issues of ethics. I asked them also what sources of information. This is going back to my characterization of sources as relational or textual. And they, not surprisingly, reported that the thing that they was most valuable to them was relational knowledge, knowledge that they was conveyed in discussions or consultations, workshops, and then textual knowledge. They conveyed that how-to articles and books were slightly preferred over theoretical articles and books. But it was the case that that all forms of knowledge were important. Both theoretical and how-to knowledge were important to these groups. And perhaps the most interesting aspect of this little study is the fact that we looked at any differences in age groups in preferences for knowledge, and we divided basically the group into young versus old, under 40 versus over 40, and found some quite interesting differences. So this will be gratifying to all of you teachers of evidence-based practice, that over the last few years, our students, the young practitioners, are very much interested and enthusiastic about knowledge overall, as well as about knowledge related to theory, practice, population groups, and ethics. So what do we conclude from this? Basically, my conclusions are that both conceptual and instrumental, I would put evidence-based practice in the instrumental side, are useful to practitioners. Practitioners value information that helps them understand and solve problems. They value learning from their colleagues. They have a slight preference for how to do their jobs on a day-to-day basis. And empirical research over theoretical articles and books. But they give their highest ratings to knowledge and information deriving from practice and relevant to practice, contributions from practitioner colleagues that are relevant to solving practice problems are the most legitimate forms of knowledge, at least from this social work readership sample. So we can stand back to draw conclusions that conceptual knowledge related to the problem and instrumental knowledge related to what works are both considered valuable by practitioners, and that they really appreciate the possibility of learning by intervening. Now, what I'd like to point out is that these findings are fundamentally consistent with other studies that have been done recently, although my interpretation is different from what we've seen from other studies. Many of you know that in 1995 and perhaps more recently, Rosen, Proctor, Morrow Howell, a group of evidence-based practitioners at Washington U in St. Louis did a content analysis of articles and found much to their dismay, they found that conceptual knowledge or conceptual rationale was what was most, as opposed to empirical evidence, was what practitioners most frequently cited as what they used to make decisions. And they also, in 99, did the literature review that showed that in terms of what evidence, what kinds of evidence is available in social work journals, 85% of the evidence that's there is related to conceptual knowledge, and 15% is related to instrumental knowledge. And both of these articles really had a huge lament. And I was recently at a conference with Bruce Fire, another evidence-based practice person whose legacy is the University of Michigan, and Ed Thomas. But he raises the same lament, or he did at the conference, by saying, and I can't believe this is true, but he claimed that every review of evidence-based practice in the social work literature is a critique rather than a carefully specified description of evidence-based practice that basically advances practice research in the field. So the findings that I found from my little study are, as I say, not very different from other findings in the field, but I would not raise such a strong lament about the state of the situation. What is evidence-based practice? Let me run through this quickly, but I've found in my experiences it's important that we all are sure we're talking about the same thing. And much of my definition comes from my good colleague, Stan McCracken. I presume that as we move forward, we're going to be using this same definition, and if not, we should talk about it. But Stan's definition that EBP is integration of the best research evidence with clinical expertise and client values is a very important definition, very useful definition. In this slide, it's really meant to make the point that Ricky made earlier that evidence-based practice has a long history, and my point earlier that it not only goes to 1940s and 50s, but long before that to the really very beginning of our field. I think that Ricky cited Bill Reed's Social Service Review article in 1994. That's a great article for reviewing this history, and Ricky incorporated some of that. But Ricky, I think you should really extend that article with much of the evidence that you had in your paper today, because what I've seen in my experiences is that in some ways there's a reconstruction of history, and that's why I'm glad we're having this conference today in terms of evidence-based practice in social work and practice research. So getting the history out there, the lived history out there, I think is a very important thing, and I hope will come out of the book that will be produced here. So this is basically, I'll call it Stan's definition of evidence-based practice. The notion that it's at the intersection of the practitioner's expertise, the best available evidence, and the client's values and expectations. Very quickly, the characteristics of evidence-based practice is it's research-based effective practice, a way of doing practice that involves the individualized process in which evidence is used to make collaborative decisions with clients and caregivers. When I was just at one of these conferences with Aaron Rosen, where he basically began his presentation with the same point that has been made a couple of times here today, that evidence-based practice is, in fact, good social work practice, he made the points that it includes a commitment to the client's best welfare, it includes a focus on values and ethics, it includes a goal-directedness, a focus not only on problems, but the capacity to focus on goals. And I think that he and Enola Proctor have done a real service to practice research by articulating goal-targeted interventions as opposed to interventions that simply are designed to reduce problems. He noted the accountability aspect or value of evidence-based practice, the focus on demonstrating effectiveness and efficiency, and the use of scientific criteria for collecting evidence and developing knowledge. I personally like to go particularly to Stan and to Gibbs as the source of my definitions for evidence-based practice. And Gibbs, in 2003, says that evidence-based practice is placing the client's benefits first. Evidence-based practitioners adopt a process for lifelong learning that involves continually posing scientific questions of direct practical importance to clients, searching objectively and efficiently for the current best evidence relevant to each question, and taking appropriate action guided by the evidence. So what then does evidence-based practice look like? The practitioner is in a position to convert information needs, their information needs, their decision-making needs, into a well-formulated question. The practitioner tracks down the best evidence with which to answer questions. They appraise evidence for its validity and utility, and they apply the results to policy and practice. And it's this this stepwise approach that is, I believe, a fundamentally fundamental element of our practice research class and practice classes. Part of this is that there are five types in the literature, five types of questions that are relevant to evidence-based practice, including effectiveness questions, preventive questions, assessment questions, descriptive questions, and questions related to risk or prognosis. The sources of evidence, sorry, I'm not keeping up with my slides. The sources of evidence that have been identified, and we'll hear more about this from Julia Littell later today, are a growing body of evidence that include federal agency and foundation panels that have identified evidence-based practices, including the Robert Wood Johnson panel of psychosocial practices for the treatment of mental illness. There are a number of substance abuse agencies that have developed databases of evidence-based practice coming out of SAMHSA. There's the Campbell and Cochrane collaborations that Julie will talk about. And there are fundamental strategies for doing individual basic electronic data literature searches. So what we have to conclude, as indicated by the growing number of articles, textbooks, institutes, centers, and websites devoted to evidence-based practice, it's become an important mode of inquiry, perhaps even an industry in the United States. Where do the critique of evidence-based practice come from? I'm going to run through this very quickly. Many of the critiques have been addressed very directly by individuals in this audience, and really amount to the straw person arguments that have so often been set up in relation to evidence-based practice. But it's been characterized as an approach that ignores client values, preferences, and cultural context, an approach that's immune to influence of organizational context at philosophical odds with the realities of social work practice. The implementation difficulties, which is really the focus of our work today, have been characterized as the fact that there's a shortage of evidence, that the availability of high-quality studies supporting social work practice decisions is growing but limited. I'm quite always reminded by this argument of a conversation with Laura Epstein many years ago. Laura, who was, very committed to making decisions based on evidence, someone asked her, but there's a lot of decisions that for which there is no evidence. And what do you do? Are you paralyzed? And, you know, she thought this was absolutely a nonsensical question. She said, of course not. You carry on. But that is an implementation difficulty that has been raised and is a reality, but becoming less so. The issue of training, time, and resources. I think what we've seen in social work education over the last 20 years is that we've become increasingly effective in supporting our students to use and consider evidence and knowledge as they make their practice decisions. Other related designs there are some logistical issues that we need to consider when we make jumps, inferential jumps from group designs or even individual designs to specific individuals, to the individual variability that occurs when we work with an individual client, and that calculating the probability with which individuals will in fact respond, given that every individual is quite different, to a given procedure is a tricky part of what this is about. Well, as you can probably tell from my from the speed at which I move through these critiques, they're not critiques that I personally can take very seriously. But I do have some other critiques that really come in the form of where do we go from here in terms of social work practice research. And part of this reflection comes from looking at what is the practice research going on by the current generation, if you will, of social work practice researchers, by Harold, Tina, Stan, Sharon, myself. Where are the really interesting questions being asked, and how does this fit into social work, to evidence-based approaches? And I know this is going to be a wonderful discussion. This is the question that in some ways drove my comments today and what I'd like to learn from our sessions. And I started talking about this with Tina the other day, and in just 5 minutes I learned a lot. But here's my dilemma as I think, where are we headed as social work researchers? What are the really interesting questions about practice research, how much of that will be in the evidence-based practice area? And so let me just outline the answer to that question for myself and my concerns with being too narrow in our definition of evidence-based practice. I think there has been there's a legitimate complaint to be made in the literature on a disproportionate emphasis on outcome evaluation, a disproportionate emphasis on the what works question. There are many process and outcome questions that deserve our attention. The kind of work that Sharon described in terms of theory development, Bill's work in this area, I think is where there's very exciting work to be done. And if we're constantly being chastised because we don't have enough outcome research, I think this will get in the way of our long-term development. I also think that we've had, and this is where I really critique Bruce Thayer's work, a singular emphasis on problem reduction as opposed to goal achievement can be a really stultifying stultifying to our work, even to use evidence-based methods. I'd like, it means that we are totally dependent on issues of diagnosis and problem definition as we think about moving forward. And so as we develop our evidence-based practices, we need to think more broadly about what goals we want to achieve as well as what problems we want to reduce. The other issue that certainly has been a focus of my own research is that our clients almost never come to us with a single problem or a clear diagnosis of that problem. They come to us with multiple problems, with multiple issues that they themselves want to address. And the current way that we approach evidence-based practice doesn't take that into account. It's been a much more linear, single problem focus on reducing individual problems. And in our research, the NIDA research that Christina talked about recently, our focus has been, in fact, on looking at the impact of comprehensive service models that are, in fact, designed to address and to achieve goals related to problems, to multiple problems that are defined by our clients. So I think that's a direction that has real promise for all of us. I also identify the need to do more process research, really similar to the kind of research that that Bill and Laura were doing when they were trying to figure out what elements of practice are useful. I guess that goes back to Florence Hollis, you reminded us. And so there are aspects of practice that hold real promise, such as looking much more closely at the client-provider relationship. This was a focus of one of our earlier symposia, looking at the value of targeting or matching services, looking at process variables in that way in the context of providing services holds real promise for us. And I also think that a real focus for the next generation of studies is in the area of judgment and decision making in practice, which is the focus really of Tina's work. So the frontier ahead of us, I think, is a very exciting one, and I think there's no question that the researchers at SSA will once again be in the lead. Finally, what are the conclusions of this rambling talk? First of all, the basic take-home message from me is that evidence-based practice is part of the ongoing development of practice research and knowledge development in social work. It isn't a fad or just the magic bullet, but part of how we are developing our understanding of how best to meet our clients' needs. A rational scientific discourse that's fundamental is important, is an important mode of inquiry in social work. And evidence-based practice provides useful knowledge for practitioners, especially younger practitioners. Practitioners also are broadly interested in both conceptual and instrumental knowledge. And the use of all forms of knowledge really consists of good practice. So thank you very much. It was a pleasure to have a chance to talk to you. Questions? I think you really raised absolutely the fundamental question that accounts for this, and I think you answered your own question very well. And Sharon also I alluded to it at the beginning of her talk in terms of it doesn't happen so often here at SSA that we think in these polarities of theory versus evidence. And so I guess that's why it's sometimes surprising when I found myself in those situations. And it's also has prompted me to sit back and say, why is this? Because it's not so familiar around here. It's not unheard of, but it's not so familiar. And I guess I come to some of the same conclusions you do, but I also think there are, you know, different ways of knowing, different ways of different epistemologies. And so, you know, a deep analysis of those issues probably would provide other other answers as well. Any other responses to that? I think it's a great question. Yeah, Harold.
Not to that question, but actually a response to the question pertaining to what you so eloquently delivered. And that is, the question,
do I need this?
Yes.
Oh, okay. first of all, do you see the use of evidence-based practice in social work as having a marketing image problem with respect to people's full understanding of what goes into it? And the second part of that is, do you also see the relationship between evidence-based practice and practice-based evidence?
Let me answer the first question.
Okay. You know I'm one of your students. So
you know, your question actually reminds me of my time as a doctoral student at Michigan. As I said, I was working with Ed Thomas and Dick Stewart, and we were certainly operating from an empirical framework, of, you could say an evidence-based framework, but the focus then was behavioral approaches, and which is part of the history, is part of, you know, part of our whole quest to improve practice. But at some point, Rosemary Sarry, for whom I have enormous respect, but who was not particularly practice research was not her thing, and someone was talking about behavioral practice approaches, and she said, well, they'll just have to change the name. And it seemed like such a superficial, but it goes to your question of marketing. Mm-hmm. And I think rather than think of it in terms of marketing, I think having conferences like we're having here to bring greater insight into what we mean by evidence-based practice, how in fact it does advance knowledge in our field, is, and how it might be expanded and how it can be the a framework for moving into the next set of questions. That's what I think we should be doing, and that's why I'm delighted this conference is going on. And as far as your second question, I don't know the answer. Seems like a little bit of a semantic thing, but,
well,
but there may be others who think that.
Yeah, I'm going to get into that when I do my presentation, but thank you. I do agree that the whole discussion on types of knowledge, quite frankly, is underexplored with respect to evidence-based practice, because I count five different knowledge bases when we use the five-step process, and in talks and in papers, I've actually pointed these things out, and people are like, you know, I didn't see that until you, so the whole notion of cultural knowledge is right there in that five-step process.
Interesting.
And we've spent an entire special issue recently on documenting that very thing.
That's
so,
right.
Thank
you. Have a question here? And do we have time? These are wonderful.
Sure.
Okay. Yes, please.
I was struck by your comment about comprehensive services.
And I know we've been talking about task-centered casework.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, task-centered as a individual or family or group kind of process. But the question I have is, what has been the agency impact of task-centered? Of what has happened in the Netherlands to social service practice because of the fact that they've implemented these kinds of practices, or what has happened to Department of Children and Family Services because they've developed and used these kinds of practices.
Ricky, can you give a quick response there, our resident expert?
I will ask Ron Rooney to make additional comments,
okay,
because he also has been consulting abroad. But I think one of the things that's happened, first of all, one point is that in the places where task-centered has become the standard model of intervention, it's almost always had government funding, serious effort put into research and training, and continued developmental research in particular, and that's particularly Great Britain and the Netherlands. And I'm really not quite sure I can answer. It's never been used as it was originally intended, as a short-term, you're in and then you're out kind of model. That it's always been episodic, task-centered segments, but it's in a service system, which is intended as a long-term kind of service to people who have major and long-term intractable problems. So it's been used in that context, and in that sense, it hasn't hasn't really influenced the agencies so much. The other thing is that There's a lot of talk about if you do pay attention to the client and you make that emphasis on what the client wants and not so much on what the agency or the organization wants, you're going to be more effective. So despite the fact that they're using task-centered, which has always had that approach, they still have to, you know, constantly train and remind themselves for it. So in that sense, it does not change the natural agency tendency to say, we know what you need and you, what you got to do. So, Ron, do you want to?
Okay. We're actually going to be talking more about that this afternoon as we talk about particular initiatives that have been undertaken and some of the obstacles in adoption and diffusion. So.
Okay, great. Another question.
The historical importance of SSA, we have to look at it not only in terms of, and I'm saying this as a public health social worker and public health policy person for the last three decades, that not only has SSA contributed in terms of our clinical base, but Grace and Edith Abbott and and Jane Addams actually changed legislation and policy in this country. They were responsible for the establishment of the Children's Bureau, and there's a wonderful paper by Chris Seifert, who's at the University of Michigan, on the Shepard-Towner Act, an exemplar of primary prevention, where she talks about these historical things. And Grace Abbott, Edith Abbott's sister, was actually the first director of the Children's Bureau nationally.
We have Grace's quote right in front of us. Justice for all children is the high ideal of a democracy.
Right. So I wanted to be sure that we are cognizant of the historical piece there. in terms of relating also to evidence-based issues that have been going on for the last decade or two, really, in the healthcare system overall, I might say that just to be pragmatic, based on current federal guidelines and current foundation funding, because of shrinking resources, if we are not evidence-based, we ain't going to get no more grants. And so the evidence basis, the strong evidence basis has been established throughout the history of social work, must be central. And I just wonder about people setting you up as a straw person to attack an evidence-based foundation.
I'm glad I have your sympathy. That was horrible.
But you know, that's kind of really self-destructive. It is, professionally, okay, to us as a profession. Certainly in medicine now, evidence-based practice is it. I mean, and you don't get funding, you don't get recognition. That's the whole purpose of all of the guidelines that are set up throughout the healthcare system in terms of current treatment practices. So for us to pursue that, I think, is critical. And
great.
So I
great.
Just wanted to.
Thank you. No, that's great. We have a question back here and then up here. Yeah. Yes, you.
Tell us your name.
I'm Ryan Rogers. I was a student in Michigan back in the Tony Tricordi, Ed Thomas days.
Okay. And we were there together, probably.
Yeah. But the reason why I felt compelled to comment was because as an African-American student at the time, we raised questions, and we raised it because of the heavy emphasis at the school on the psychodynamic position, which many of us felt was a position which tended to blame the victim for their condition. And we tried at that time, and I remember specifically, we formed an association called Association of Black Social Workers with Students from Wayne State. And the reason, what occasioned me to make the comment because of what you said about the straw piece with yourself. Because
I really got your sympathy, I'm sorry.
We raised a critique then, and I guess that critique still remains with me 44 years later, namely that when we come to talk about the question of evidence, we leave out the environment, that is, the influence environments as causative factors, i.e., social work, at least one of the critiques I have is that we tend to posit the problem with the client and not give enough consideration to environmental factors such as the current economic crisis. And my hope has always been with this development, even when I was at Jane Addams, was that the trend and tendency of evidence-based practice would lead to a recognition of the primacy of environmental factors. I haven't seen that happen yet, so I'm just raising it now because I want to hear some commentary in this body on that question. I think it's a pivotal question. Because it's a question of, do we want the client to accommodate himself or herself to ever-deteriorating situation? By the way, this arose out of a context, and I think it's necessary to put that forth as for the younger people. We raise these within the context of the civil rights struggle, when discrimination and legal segregation was a real issue. And so it was a real question of, how do you get a client to accommodate itself to Jim Crow? You can't, a Jim Crow environment. So I would hope that some of you can throw some light on that question even this late day.
Okay. Where's the response here? Can you speak up, or maybe you can hand him the... Tell us your name also.
I'm Dan Williams. And I think just to address the gentleman's concern that there is a big movement now in evidence-based practice to talk about culturally competent interventions that address particular ethnic minorities and their particular social circumstances. I know that's particularly true, like doing interventions for HIV/AIDS, where that are facing greater political structures, gender issues, stuff like that. We've talked about safer sex practices. And like Africa and India, there's patriarchal models where women can't choose to use condoms for the rest of their partner because... I'm sorry, I don't like speaking into these. I just simply saying that, and, you know, particularly looking at interventions or evidence-based practice interventions for, like, HIV/AIDS in countries like Africa and India, they are looking at culturally competent interventions because there's structures in place that prohibit or make it difficult to get solid outcomes in the sense of, like, women can't ask their partners to use condoms because it's more of a patriarchal or dominant model. They'd be faced to be beat by their husbands. There's political barriers to getting proper treatments and medications out there. So looking at the bigger structure is part of the evidence-based practice under and designing culturally competent interventions.
Right. Very important. Next frontier for sure. Yes, Annie.
I was at SSA, it wasn't taught, and it's also over 10 years ago now. So it seems from the cognitive bent and the task-centered discussions that evidence-based practice favors a cognitive model, but as I understand it, it seems like it could be atheoretical, and I wondered about that, because certainly with revolutionary writing in the neurology field and what we know about the brain, there's as Sharon was talking about, the high road and the low road, and where emotions sit, certainly when the amygdala is activated and in moments of crisis or danger. It seems like it could be atheoretical, and I just wondered what you thought about that, or if you could respond to that.
I think I'll refer this to Stan because he speaks very eloquently on this point, as I recall. Basically, the notion is, does evidence-based practice favor one theoretical perspective or another?
I don't know that the model favors it. Certainly that in terms of if you look at the evidence that's been gathered, behavioral and cognitive certainly have kind of... dominated the amount of literature, but there's when I work with agencies, and my natural group are practitioners. Okay, when I work with agencies, if I go into an agency and the primary approach is psychodynamic, I say, well, okay, then let's look at the literature that fits with a model that the practitioners already have. Instead of saying, well, let's train the practitioners and make them think in terms of cognitive behavioral, I say, let's look at an interpersonal therapy and brief psychodynamic therapy because there is a good literature in that area. So let's, going back to the question of the environment, the approach that I generally use now in terms of thinking about evidence-based practice is the context of service and the context of the client and the context of the practitioner and their history has to be taken into account. So I'm not big on Procrustean beds. Okay, I don't cut a lot of people's feet off if I can have any choice about it. So I'll say if you've got a problem area and a particular mindset that's going to be more acceptable to the practitioners, let's see what the literature looks like. And that doesn't mean that we look for research to support your approach, your methodological approach, because anybody in here knows that we can find research to support anything. But if we look at, is there a substantial body of evidence? There is. In many of the areas that we look at, there's a great body of evidence. So, yeah, I don't think that there's any war between research and theory or between the art and the science of practice. I mean, I think it's a foolish waste of time.
I just would like to note that one other... thing that was part of my experience when I came to SSA was this was the beginning, and Laura was chairing the committee, of what continues to be our approach to clinical theory and to getting away from theory wars or privileging theory or thinking that research is more related to one theory or another, and hopefully teaching all of our students that there are strengths and limitations to all theories, and the integration of these that I think Bill's work personifies and Sharon's work personifies has been a result of this more integrative approach to thinking about theory. Ron?
I keep thinking in this regard what Sharon and Jean, you wrote a long time ago about dichotomous thinking and how this issue has been framed in terms of you are this or you're that. And as I was hearing the concerns that have been raised, you could take each of them seriously, and that doesn't mean that you have any concern. You think about, well, what is the alternative? If the alternative is evidence-based, or else what? Or no evidence, or you don't consult evidence? It's not a good alternative to select. So the way this has been framed, some of it feels as if the people are threatened by a kind of a religious fervor of the way it's been marketed, and feeling that if I buy any of this, then it rejects much of what I've done. And so there seems there has to be a way of marketing that's much more humble, as many people have attempted to do, to say that there are many other sources of knowledge besides, and you consult them. But that's frequently not what people pick up on.
Good. Let's get one new voice. How are we doing for time?
We'll need to stop probably after one more question.
Oh, we're half hour over. Oh, my goodness. Okay, one more question. And it's lunchtime.
Hi, I'm Frank Martinez. I'm from Huntington Beach, California.
And,
welcome. I taught at Cal State Long Beach.
Oh, great.
And I wanted to kind of shift it a little bit. One of the things that I've been listening to cognitive, and I'm task-oriented, and evidence-based kind of model, and I've certainly been exposed to a number of those things. One thing that I like to kind of throw out is the idea that that, you know, whenever I taught, but primarily when I practice, I found that the thing that was most effective for me, and I haven't done a lot of research into that, but is the idea that is that I follow the model of we deal with people physically, emotionally, intellectually, and spiritually, okay? And because I see them holistically, okay? So the part that I'm saying is that my feeling and what I have found the most successful is that when you change the heart, you change the person. Knowledge simply makes you a little more understanding of your problems and situation, but when you change the heart, people begin to kind of have a passion to pursue that. And what I have found is that sometimes you can operate horizontally, but if you don't operate also vertically, that doesn't mean your model, but their model, where they're at. We're talking about the issue of values and beliefs. When you get people what I have found that most people are looking for meaning in life, purpose in life, and you know they're feeling kind of lost in the whole mirage of issues, problems, relationships, and everything else. That and I have found that when you really plug into that, I'm not saying ignore the other aspects. I think that's very important because they're very connected to their humanness. But the idea is the other part is sometimes very powerful, and I feel is often ignored.
Great. Thank you very much. And I think with that...
Yes, I don't know what the arrangements are exactly. There should be someone here who can...
Lunch is to our right, so lunch is served, and thank you very much.
And we will return back at 1 o'clock.